This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 874 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip 4.5 months into the fraudulent ceasefire, while adequate and dignified shelter materials, food supplies, and medications continue to be blockaded by Israel and its Western partners. Heavy rains once again hit Gaza this week, flooding thousands of tents and leaving families without proper protection from the elements. Two Palestinians were killed on Wednesday evening in eastern Deir al-Balah in central Gaza in an Israeli attack that targeted civilians, according to medical sources at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. On Tuesday, a Palestinian was killed in an Israeli drone attack in Gaza City, according to the Wafa news agency. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza says that as of February 25th, 618 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,600 injured since the so-called ceasefire agreement went into effect last October. Writing in Middle East Eye this week, journalist and researcher Maha Husseini reports that, quote, despite the relative lull in large-scale bombardment, attacks have not fully ceased. On the first 2 days of Ramadan, the Israeli military killed two Palestinians and injured four others across the Gaza Strip. Husseini adds that since 2023, Palestinians in Gaza have observed Ramadan under Israeli-imposed starvation, quote, during which Israeli forces killed hundreds of Palestinians waiting for aid in Gaza City in what was dubbed the Flower Massacres. This Ramadan, she says, Gaza's markets resemble the pre-war period, with shelves once again stocked with goods. Quote, yet for many in Gaza, those items remain largely out of reach, unaffordable amid the near total devastation of the impoverished strip's economic sector. Many families are forced to spend their days filling water and collecting firewood to heat their tent shelters and prepare food. By the end of January, only about 20% of the allotted 1,500 trucks of cooking gas have entered Gaza, Husseini notes, so families are dependent on dwindling amounts of firewood to cook during Ramadan. Israel is continuing to deny medical evacuations to children and adult patients alike after nearly 2.5 years of genocide and the destruction of the health system across Gaza. And while Israel continues to block necessary medications, medical equipment, and supplies to repair vital health infrastructure from entry. On February 22nd, 2-year-old Nidal Abu Rabi died after waiting for treatment for a disease that affected his liver and spleen. Reporter Asama Kahlout recorded Nidal's mother, Iman Hamdoun, in shock and grief, holding her son's little body that was wrapped in blankets. She says that the evacuation referral for Nidal had been in place for 3 months, but Israel kept denying him permission to leave Gaza for medical treatment. Quote, my voice is gone from the amount of appeals I made, she says. No one cares about me or about the child. Today I lost my son. I don't want to lose my daughter too. Iman says that her daughter is receiving treatment at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital for kidney disease and has low protein and albumin levels, and that every time she is admitted, her situation is difficult and she's put on oxygen. The World Health Organization said last month that more than 18,500 people in the Gaza Strip, including at least 4,000 children, still require evacuation for medical treatment unavailable in the territory. The Gaza Ministry of Health said on February 2nd that more than 1,200 patients have already died while waiting to leave for urgent medical treatment. New evidence has been released this week in a 73-page report by the independent investigative research organizations Forensic Architecture and Earshot into the massacre of 15 Palestinian rescue workers in Tal el-Sultan in southern Gaza nearly a year ago, on March 23rd, 2025. In the attack, as you may remember, Israel killed 8 aid and rescue workers with the Palestine Red Crescent Society, 6 from the Palestinian Civil Defense, and a staff member of UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees. The Israeli military was forced to change its story about the ambush several times following the discovery of the bodies in a mass grave, along with their flattened vehicles, and the emergence of video and audio recordings taken by the rescue workers, reports Dropsite News. An internal military inquiry ultimately did not recommend any criminal action against the army units responsible for the attack. Earshot and Forensic Architecture's investigation, their report says, quote, offers detailed evidence regarding the circumstances of the incident in Tel el-Sultan, including extrajudicial executions, a survivor being forced to work at an Israeli military checkpoint, and efforts to conceal, disturb, and erase evidence relating to the attack. Some of the findings included in the report reveal that Israeli soldiers, quote, ambushed and subjected Palestinian aid workers to a near-continuous assault for over 2 hours, even though the soldiers never came under fire, and that, quote, at least 910 gunshots were documented across 3 video and audio recordings of the attack. The vast majority of these gunshots, at least 844, were fired over just 5 minutes and 30 seconds. At least 93% of the gunshots recorded in the first minutes of the attack were fired directly towards the emergency vehicles and aid workers by Israeli soldiers, the report adds. And during this time, at least 5 shooters fired simultaneously. Witness testimonies suggest as many as 30 soldiers were present in the area. Furthermore, Israeli soldiers, quote, first maintained fixed firing positions from the elevated sandbank, then walked toward the aid workers while continuing to shoot. Upon reaching the aid workers, the soldiers moved between them and the vehicles and executed some of the aid workers at point-blank range, as close as 1 meter away, Dropsite notes. In the 37 days following the attack, one of the 2 survivors was detained without charge, tortured, and interrogated in relation to the incident at the Sde Tayman detention camp. And in the days and weeks that followed, the area surrounding the site of the massacre was further transformed by the Israeli military's construction of the so-called Morag Corridor and the building of an aid distribution site operated by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, the report explains. Speaking to Dropsite, former UN official in Palestine Jonathan Whittall, who was one of the team members on the ground when the mass grave was discovered 5 days after the attack, and who provided evidence to Forensic Architecture and Earshot for their investigation, said, quote, following our discovery of the mass grave, the narrative from Israeli forces shifted multiple times. We were fed several versions of a blatant lie. The men we retrieved last year were medics. We found them in their uniforms, ready to save lives, only to be killed by Israeli forces, fully aware of their protected status. This illustrates an abhorrent disregard for international law, he continued, where any Palestinian in an Israeli-designated evacuation zone is targeted regardless of their civilian status. It highlights the total lack of accountability under which these forces operate. International governments continue to arm and trade with a leadership accused of genocide, whose soldiers massacred medics and buried them in a grave marked by the siren light of the ambulance they destroyed, Whittall said. On Tuesday, the British Palestine Committee hosted a launch event for the new report in the UK Parliament. In addition to providing the findings of the report, researchers included evidence that a British reconnaissance plane flew over the site of the massacre only 2 days following the killings. The committee and the research groups are demanding that the UK government, quote, reveal any footage taken during that flight, as it may contain evidence crucial for bringing the perpetrators of the massacre to justice for their crimes under international criminal law. Speakers warned that failure to do so may amount to obstruction of justice. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers and settlers shot and killed two Palestinian teenagers this week. In the early morning hours of Sunday, February 22nd, Israeli forces killed a 17-year-old Palestinian boy in the northern town of Beit Furik. According to Defense for Children International Palestine, Mohammed Wahbi Abdulaziz Hanani had just finished evening prayers in the Zalmut Mosque on Saturday evening when Israeli forces in heavily armored military vehicles arrived in the area. Mohammed and other young Palestinians allegedly threw stones toward the military vehicles for about 2 minutes before Israeli forces opened fire, striking Mohammed in the head from a distance of about 40 meters. The children's rights group reported that, quote, soldiers rushed toward Mohammed, who had collapsed on the ground, and searched the area before an Israeli military ambulance arrived and its military paramedics began to administer first aid. A few minutes later, a Palestinian ambulance arrived at the scene, and Israeli soldiers obstructed the paramedics' access to Mohammed. After several minutes of discussion, the Israeli soldiers allowed the Palestinian paramedics to provide first aid under their supervision. The Palestinian ambulance transported Mohammed to the Rafidia governmental hospital in Nablus. On the way, it encountered a closed military checkpoint, delaying the trip by several minutes. Mohammed's heart stopped in the ambulance and paramedics conducted cardiopulmonary resuscitation until they reached the hospital, where doctors in the operating room cleaned the wound and tried to stop the bleeding, but he was pronounced dead just after midnight. Mohammed is the fourth Palestinian child killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank in 2026, according to documentation collected by DCIP. Israeli forces and settlers killed 56 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank in 2025. On February 20th, Israeli settlers shot and killed 19-year-old Nasrallah Abu Siyam in the village of Mukhmas. The armed settlers invaded the village and attacked a farmer. Abu Siyam and other residents intervened to defend the farmer, and Israeli forces then arrived and shot tear gas, sound grenades, and live ammunition. A resident of the village, speaking to the Associated Press, said that, quote, when the settlers saw the army, they were encouraged and started shooting live bullets. He added that the settlers clubbed those already injured with sticks after they had fallen to the ground. Abu Siyam was a U.S. citizen born in Philadelphia. His family has demanded accountability for his killing, while the U.S. State Department told reporters that it was, quote, carefully monitoring the situation. Elsewhere in the West Bank, Israeli settlers torched and desecrated a mosque in the village of Tel, southwest of Nablus, on February 23rd. Settlers sprayed racist graffiti on the walls of the Abu Bakr as-Siddiq Mosque, including slogans such as price tag and revenge. Other settler attacks were reported in Susia, Masafer Yatta, Jerusalem, and in Jalud near Nablus. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Noor's short life of unimaginable suffering by Sumaya Nassar, a teacher writing from Gaza. When the genocide on Gaza began, my daughter Noor was not yet 3 months in my womb, Nassar writes. Quote, I carried her inside me while living the bitterness of displacement and the cruelty of war. She was born in April 2024 under the harshest of conditions, amid a suffocating siege. She became the hope that kept me alive. I named her Noor, which means light, so she could guide me through the darkness surrounding Gaza. In mid-September, my family and I fled to a house in Deir al-Balah. I hoped we would finally be safe in an area the Israeli occupation had declared a, quote, safe zone. On the morning of September 23rd, 2025, I woke early, dressed my daughter, gently combed her soft hair, and prepared her to meet her grandparents who had arrived from Gaza City at midnight. Then a violent explosion shook the entire place. I didn't look for anything except Noor. I screamed her name again and again. Then I suddenly heard her father yelling, "Help! Noor, quick!" We found her lying on the ground. She had fallen from the third floor all the way down to the lower level when the upper floor was bombed. Still, unmoving, no trace of blood, I screamed. My husband and I were terrified to even touch her. Our hands froze above her tiny body. Her uncle, Mohammed, 22, gently placed his hand over her heart and felt a faint heartbeat. He looked at us calmly and said, "She's still alive." My husband ran outside without realizing he had no shoes on, searching desperately for any means of transport. He saw our neighbor getting into his car, heading to the market, and begged him to take them to the hospital. My husband tried to pick up Noor, but he couldn't. His hands were trembling uncontrollably, and fear had numbed his entire body. So Mohammed carried her gently and placed her in the car. I went with them to the hospital. When the doctor saw her, he looked at me with a silence that spoke plenty, as if he were saying, "There's nothing we can do. You may lose her." She was rushed into the intensive care unit. She was the only child in the unit at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir Abala. She lay on the bed showing no signs of life. Her small body was covered in tubes and surrounded by machines. Long visits were forbidden. I was only allowed 10 minutes a day. I would place my hand on her tiny body and find it as cold as ice. My heart shattered again and again. She had internal bleeding, doctors said. Her skull was fractured from the fall. Every minute I prayed that her bleeding would stop, that she would survive. After 12 long days in the ICU, my beloved girl finally emerged from the critical stage and was moved to the pediatric ward. She survived, but at what cost? The head injury and what doctors said was bleeding in her brain caused Noor to lose her sight and her ability to move. After a long period in the hospital where doctors were unable to offer the treatment my daughter needed, I had no choice but to return with her to a tent in a displacement camp in Deir Abala, where we had found shelter. I stand helpless before her suffering. I cannot restore her vision. I cannot help her walk or play with other children. She cries constantly, out of pain, boredom, and confusion. Every few seconds, she calls out, "Mama," just to make sure I'm beside her. She clings to me, believing that I can protect her, even from Israeli airstrikes. Those are excerpts from Noor's Short Life of Unimaginable Suffering by Sumaya Nassar, a teacher writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and reclamation across Palestine and around the world. In Gaza, photographer Khamis Al-Refi captured images of Palestinians performing the first Taraweeh prayer of Ramadan on the ruins of the great Omari Mosque in Gaza City, built in the 7th century and largely destroyed in Israeli attacks during the first few months of the genocide. And this past week, young singer Mohammed Al-Shabraoui walked down the streets with his friends, singing a song about the pride and dignity of Gaza. The lyrics are, quote, "For your sake, your people stand noble. Oh, our steadfast Gaza, there's no way that Israel can take Gaza. The people of Gaza declared it. For your sake, the siege will be lifted. With you, we die with our heads held high. We will come out from beneath the wall. The people of Gaza declared it." And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.